Hi, I'm Doug Gordon, and this is Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Paul Thomas Anderson is one of the most distinctive and masterful filmmakers of his generation. The writer-director's 8 movies have received over 24 Academy Award nominations. Anderson has worked with many of our finest contemporary actors, including Julianne Moore, Tom Cruise, Joaquin Phoenix, Daniel Day-Lewis, and Philip Seymour Hoffman. Film critic Adam Naiman is the author of Paul Thomas Anderson, Masterworks. In the book, Adam casts a critical eye on Anderson's entire career and argues why Anderson has become a modern auteur.
I think he's like an auteur two or three generations removed. Because in the original definition, some of what the French critics saw as auteurism was just kind of like a really diligent professionalism working within the system, and you bring your touch as a director to scripts that aren't yours and to projects that you're sort of indifferent to. I mean, Anderson is more of a, to use a musical analogy, he's more of a singer-songwriter. You know, he's a writer-director. And that differentiates him from some other filmmakers in this period who people might put on his level, like a Catherine Bigelow or a David Fincher. That's not denigrating them. They're great filmmakers, but they don't necessarily write their films. You know, Anderson's never directed something that he's been hired to direct. He's generated every project. And I think that that's where some of the ambivalence about how precious his ideas at the beginning were for some critics. And now it kind of stands where it's why I'm so amazed by him to be able to adapt a novel like Inherent Vice or to create a script like Phantom Thread out of whole cloth. You know, it's dazzling stuff.
Yeah, Phantom Thread out of whole cloth, very well said. You decided to structure your book by the chronological order of the eras that Anderson's films take place in rather than their production order. You start with There Will Be Blood, which is probably Anderson's most critically acclaimed film, but it wasn't Anderson's first epic. You say in your book that its imaginative scope was new. How so?
Because I think that he's working with things outside of his immediate experience. I mean, this is something, I don't come out and make this comparison in the book, but I've written about it elsewhere, where there seems to be this thing that happens to certain, let's call them cinephilic directors around the time they hit 40, you know? Spielberg makes 1941 and E.T., and then all of a sudden he makes The Color Purple. Tarantino makes Kill Bill, which is about nothing except his own cinephilia, and then makes Inglourious Basterds, which is also about nothing but his own cinephilia, but is also a Holocaust, not Holocaust, World War II movie. I think with Anderson, there was a feeling that he had mined his own adolescence and his own present tense, and he's not the kind of filmmaker who's going to extrapolate into the future. He's not a sci-fi filmmaker. So I think the interest came in tackling history. And what I mean by imaginative scope is that There Will Be Blood, and hopefully the people listening to this have seen the film, and if you've seen it, it's a very easy movie to remember because of how stark and graphically powerful it is. It's like a movie that is split between incredible fidelity and research to recreating the turn of the century and an abstraction that is like science fictional and Kubrickian. You know, it is immediately recognizable as capital H history while not seeming bound to the cliches and conventions of period pieces. And whatever flaws the movie might have or whatever arguments people make about its central metaphor about capitalism and religion or the believability of the plot, I think it's inarguable that he put things together on a level of sound and image and location and production design that just took the collective breath away.
Yeah, the film paired perhaps the greatest living actor with one of the greatest living directors. Can you talk about Anderson's relationship with Daniel Day-Lewis?
Sure. I mean, I think that much like Sandler in Punch Drunk Love, this and a bit with Philip Baker Hall in Hard Eight, Day-Lewis was the first time that Anderson keyed an entire movie to one person's presence. There Will Be Blood just is Daniel Day-Lewis. And I think the two interacted at just the right time. I think the two interacted at the time when Anderson had the discipline to key a movie to one story, one character, one psychology instead of his ensemble thing. And he caught Day-Lewis at one of the last moments before he became too iconic to play anything. But when you go back to the movie, what is quite fun to rewatch is how funny the performance is, where there are so many little disgusted asides and sotto voce insults and just kind of funny little bits of physical comedy.
Heard you were planning some renovations.
Yes, our congregation is growing strongly. We need more room.
Well, that was one goddamn hell of a show.
There Will Be Blood will always be closely tied in history to the Coen brothers' No Country for Old Men. They were actually filmed almost side by side in Texas, and No Country famously edged out There Will Be Blood at the 2008 Academy Awards. Many critics consider Anderson's film the best of the decade. As someone who's written extensively about both the Coen brothers and Anderson, if you could bring only one of these two films to a deserted island, which one are you bringing, Adam Naiman?
Oh, you know what? I don't want to undermine either of my books. I'm going to give you a trick answer, which is the best best American film of 2007 is Zodiac by David Fincher, which to me is less immediately spectacular than either of those two movies. But I think, to use the marathon analogy, it's got legs.
Yeah, rewatchability.
But I would say this about, you know, the comparison you bring up is an interesting one. I think that the Coens, as always, are very controlled and scrupulous in their meanings. And as great as No Country for Old Men is, and it's a great film, I mean, full stop, it's a great movie, it doesn't, I think, have the extra gear that There Will Be Blood has. I think that with No Country, they were working very carefully from Cormac McCarthy. They made changes, and I wrote about them in my book, that I think make it very much their material. But control is the name of the game there. And There Will Be Blood, I think, by being willing to be so inflated and so ambitious and really so wild, it doesn't surprise me that maybe for some people it holds up as more of a as more of an event.
Yeah, well, I enjoyed the trick answer. Nice to get some David Fincher content.
I love Zodiac.
Yeah, yeah. Let's talk about Anderson's film Boogie Nights. When it premiered at the Toronto International Film Festival in 1997, film critic Owen Gleiberman wrote that he has seen the new Quentin Tarantino, and his name is Paul Thomas Anderson. Did you have a similar reaction the first time you saw Boogie Nights?
No, my reaction was, thank God they let me sneak in. I saw that movie when I was 16. I wore a trench coat to look older, which is stupid. I mean, when I saw Boogie Nights, I should have been in the absolute target demographic to like it. I'm not going to romanticize my own adolescence, but like, you're 16, heterosexual male, here's sex, drugs, rock and roll, incredible amounts of nudity, and yeah, we're all really hopped up on the idea of Quentin Tarantino. I mean, Pulp Fiction was holy writ for us when we were in high school. And yet, the first time I saw Boogie Nights, I remembered being disappointed, and I wasn't sure if I was trying to be, you know, more thoughtful and mature than my years, or if there was just something in the drama of it that I didn't like. And I think it's a fair thing that now, as an almost 40-year-old guy, I have the same feeling. I thought the first half of the film is ecstatic and wonderful, and then wondered why the movie feels so determined to punish the characters for that sense of liberation. And I think that in some ways it's a brilliant film, because the 70s are hedonistic and anything goes. And in the 80s, the Reagan era, the political boom lowers, you know, and all that freedom and fun is gone, and the characters are left with the consequences of their actions. And I've always been split between whether that's kind of acute social analysis or a moralism and a conservatism that really is a drag.
This is the future. Videotape tells the truth.
Wait a minute. You come into my house, my party, to tell me about the future. That the future is tape, videotape, and not film. That it's amateurs and not professionals. I'm a filmmaker. That's why I will never make a movie on videotape. And I'll tell you something else. I will never, ever loan out any of the actors.
In the 90s, every distributor wanted a Tarantino. And even though Anderson's a different fish, a different animal, a different kind of director, New Line absolutely packaged Boogie Nights as the new Pulp Fiction. The retro 70s font, the soundtrack, placing it at film festivals, the blurbs from critics. They were trying to package him as a new Tarantino.
Yeah, that's interesting, yeah. In 1999, Anderson released Magnolia. This film has a very compelling opening. Can you tell us about the opening?
Yeah, the opening, well, if you want to make a compelling anything, you just hire Ricky Jay, the late magician who,
yeah,
I don't know, on the short list of the like 10 most entertaining people I've ever seen. If you've ever watched his magic or his comedy, I mean, Ricky Jay ruled. And he kind of narrates these coincidences, which again, I think fed into that post-Tarantino idea of multiple narratives and intersection. And the thing about the overture of Magnolia is it's incredibly compelling. It has this sense of portent and how is this all going to connect and of strange things happening.
They died for the murder of Sir Edmund William Godfrey, husband, father, pharmacist, and all-around gentleman resident of Greenberry Hill, London. He was murdered by three vagrants whose motive was simple robbery. They were identified as Joseph Green, Stanley Berry, and Daniel Hill. Green, Berry, Hill. And I would like to think this was only a matter of chance.
It's dazzling filmmaking. It's mm-hmm. just then it stays in the back of your mind as the rest of the movie is going on and you find yourself wondering, well, when's that going to pay off? And I'm not saying that it doesn't. I mean, you have these three impossible events in miniature and Magnolia as a whole builds to an impossible event. It builds to a rain of frogs, which if you're on Anderson's wavelength is a brilliantly apocalyptic, regenerative, biblical event. And if you're not on the movie's wavelength, it's a cop-out.
Has Anderson ever said what that scene was intended to represent, what we're supposed to take from that scene?
Well, I quote him a bit as he read some cryptozoology or some cryptobiology, I think by a writer named Charles Fort, which was sort of about uncanny events and the animal kingdom. I tend to be a believer that the best movie enigmas are the ones that are somewhat inexplicable. If anything, I might have liked The Rain of Frogs more if he hadn't gone in after the fact and put all those Exodus 8:2 jokes in the movie, you know, and it had really truly come out of nowhere. But I think he's smart enough to not say exactly what he wanted it to represent. And again, if we're talking about guts, it takes guts to have people sit for 2 hours and 40 minutes and then give them that as an ending.
Yeah,
and that's definitely why when we're not talking in the context of film criticism or film culture, a conversation like this, when you were just like, that's also a big movie that came out around Christmas time, of course people hated it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, very well said. Anderson has said that Magnolia could, for all intents and purposes, be called an adaptation of Amy Mann's songs. The way that Anderson uses her song Wise Up in the movie is very striking. Can you tell us a bit about this and how it affects the viewer?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the make or break scene, I think, for Magnolia. And there are other scenes, as I've indicated, I'm not so fond of, but I love that sequence, and I really do, where you have all these characters who have found themselves at different emotional impasses, different moments of struggle, failure. Really, at that point, most of the film's stories are at a kind of low point where they're very uncertain. And he does something so, I mean, on the one hand, it's so simple, which is they're all sad. So what if they're all singing a sad song? No, it's not going to stop. To you, wiser. No, it's not going to stop. So just give up. It transcends any kind of reality. The movie turns into a musical. And it's pretty amazing. It takes interior life and externalizes it. It takes 9 separate characters or stories and unites them. And it uses pop to narrate an emotional state. And it dares you, I think, to be cynical or to be smarmy, or to be smug, or to say, this is ridiculous. It dares that. And there's an example, I think, where his daring works. Because for me, it spills over into real feeling.
Yeah, it's very audacious in its
daring. It's audacious.
Yeah, very audacious, yeah. Let's talk a bit about Punch Drunk Love, which starred Adam Sandler and was released in 2002. You say that although the film got some good reviews, the general impression was one of bewilderment. Can you explain that?
A lot of critics, they'll say, whether or not it's the best thing he made, that's the turning point. Away from ensembles into character studies, away from general realism into a kind of completely stylized, you know, mise-en-scène and narrative world. It can't be overstated how funny it was in 2002 for Paul Thomas Anderson to make an Adam Sandler movie. And not in a contemptuous way or a condescending way. Everything about Punch Drunk Love was what was understood at that time as an Adam Sandler vehicle. He's this awkward, rageaholic loner who can't seem to get his life to work out and overreacts to everything and falls in love with an impossibly patient woman and learns to respect himself. I mean, it's the same plot as Happy Gilmore, you know, they're the same, I mean, or Big Daddy. I mean, it is. And I think that Anderson saw something in Sandler that has always been there. And now you have Sandler dazzling people in a movie like Uncut Gems, the directors of which Josh and Benny Safdie wrote the foreword to this book as a nice little circle. He saw something in Sandler and he got what a really amazing performance out of him.
I don't know if there is anything wrong because I don't know how other people are. I sometimes cry a lot for no reason.
With Daniel Day-Lewis, you know you're going to get a performance. You know, with Sandler, I think it was seen at the time as Blood from a Stone. But it really, Sandler's always had the talent and the depth, I think. That's why people were so bewildered by it. I mean, it's like, what does an Adam Sandler art film even look like?
That's like the strongest thing you can say about a movie in a world where there's all these retreads that there's nothing like it to make something that distinctive.
Yeah. And I think it's a real badge of honor, not just that he won Best Director at Cannes, because Cannes gives out awards that are sometimes good or sometimes bad. When I look at awards from Cannes, see, with the Academy, it's a faceless group of 5,000 people. With Cannes, you know who's on the jury. And the highest compliment that you can pay Punch-Drunk Love to me is that David Lynch wanted to give it an award.
Yeah.
Because Lynch, for me, is the guy who hovers above all these guys. He's the great American filmmaker of the second half of the 20th century. For me, that's not an objective fact. It's just what he is to me. And the fact that he watched a movie like Punch-Drunk Love and wanted to like it was that's a good endorsement.
Absolutely. Probably the best endorsement you can get. What is next for Paul Thomas Anderson?
He is shooting, supposedly, a coming-of-age high school comedy in and around the San Fernando Valley. Photos have emerged online of Bradley Cooper screaming in character, not at Paul. And, you see Anderson there on set wearing masks. I know that one of the big talking points is that he's cast the late Philip Seymour Hoffman's son in a lead role. We didn't get to Hoffman here, but it's a beautiful gesture because Hoffman was always in his films, except for There Will Be Blood. He was in every one of Anderson's films up till his own death. And the idea of him doing a high school comedy is sort of counterintuitive since his movies have gotten more mature. But it might also be interesting for him to look back at adolescence with some distance. And the coming-of-age movie is something that a lot of American filmmakers do. Richard Linklater just recently did it with Boyhood, for instance. So I'm interested to see a movie like Moonlight by Barry Jenkins. So I'm interested to see what Anderson comes up with for sure.
Adam Naiman, thank you very much.
Hey, it was such a pleasure. Thank you.
Adam Naiman is a film critic and the author of Paul Thomas Anderson, Masterworks. You can find out more about Adam and Anderson's films at wpr.org/beta.
I'm glad if people can use the King of Confidence to sort of sort through our own times through what the historian Barbara Tuchman once called a distant mirror.
Author Miles Harvey introduces us to the man who may well be the most audacious con man you've never heard of, James Strang. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.